after I brought Liberty back from having her bred in Oregon, the first month, really almost probably 5.5 weeks or so of the pregnancy, the dog is pretty well normal. You can do almost anything with him. So one of the places that we used to enjoy going when we got invitations to go up there, and was certainly a great place to work with Liberty, was Camp David. And there were several occasions that we were invited by the Fords to come to Camp David for the day. Lots of fun activities to do up there. But this particular incident that I want to talk about, and I'm limited in what I can say about it, but it's still a great story. When I was in Oregon, I had submitted an idea of what it was going to cost for the trip, for the airplane flight, for the rental car, for lodging, food, and all that kind of stuff. And believe it or not, it came up to $800 and some odd. Remember, this was 1975.
Yes, that's big money in the 70s, yeah.
Yeah. So I got I was given a check from President Ford by his financial secretary for that, which I put in the bank. And anyway, as I started to keep track of what I was spending out there, the people who owned the stud dog gave me a truck to drive, and I just didn't have to spend all the money. So I bought a training aid out there for retrievers called a retriever trainer, and I'll go into that a little bit more in a minute, and still brought back like $150, which I refunded back to his secretary, and she said, "This is a first. I've never had anybody come back from a trip. They always come looking for more money. They never bring me money back." But anyway, so on this particular trip to Camp David, when we got up there, my ex-wife and myself, President Ford was in the swimming pool. So their home up there is called Aspen. It's referred to as a cabin, but it's a bit more than a cabin. And it has a big deck on the back, and then below Aspen is a small golf course, like maybe a three-hole golf course, and a very nice swimming pool and that sort of thing. So President Ford was in the swimming pool with Liberty, and he got out, and we were talking, and he put a robe on, and he said, "Hey, I'd like to see what you're doing with her and her field work, you know, her retrieving and all that. And I've never really seen that. And this seems like a good place to do it." I said, "It's a great place to do it." And I said, let me run down to my car and grab a bag, and I'll be right back." So when you go to Camp David, you can't even stop outside the gate. You'll be just run off. But if you have an invitation there, then you pull up to the gate. They check you in. You pull inside and park. And there's no motorized vehicles inside Camp David other than golf carts. So you either walk, ride a bicycle, take a golf cart, something like that. And the place is also very secure. And that's all I'm going to say about that. It's very secure. And so I walked down to my vehicle and grabbed this bag that had my dog training equipment in it and brought it back up to what is essentially their backyard. And President Ford was still down there, and he had Liberty. So I took out this retriever trainer. So I'll try to explain this so people can visualize it. It's a dummy launcher. So a dummy being a canvas cylinder, maybe 4 inches across and 10 inches long, with a metal tube through the middle of it. And the launcher breaks open like the old kind of shotguns, that like a single-shot shotgun. So you lift the handle, and it breaks open. And you put in a .22 blank, but not the ordinary .22 blank like a starter's pistol would use, but these are ramset loads. And ramset loads are what's used to shoot nails into concrete. So they're powerful .22 blanks, and they come in different sizes, and they're color-coded. And purple is the most powerful. So I actually put a purple load in, and we got Liberty ready, and I actually handed the retriever trainer to President Ford, and I said, "Now, you want to hold it like a certain way because it kicks, and you're going to pull this firing pin back and let it go, and when it goes off, it's going to be really loud. In fact, I remember saying it's going to sound like a .30-06 going off, and it's going to shoot the dummy out, and then she'll make the retrieve and come back." And so I handed it to him to fire, and then he pulled the pin back, but he didn't let it go, and he eased it back in, and he said, "You know, I'm just not that into all guns and stuff." He said, "Why don't you fire it?" So I took it and fired it. Liberty made the retrieve. It was about a 100-yard shot. She went down, made the retrieve, made it all the way back. because of this is one of the places where the Secret Service can kind of back off the first family and give them some space, there were no Secret Service agents in the immediate vicinity. And however, they did hear that shot go off. And it was a very frightening experience for them. It was something that even though the president and I discussed it, how loud it was going to be, that I made the mention of a 30-06, neither of us realized what we were about to do to the United States Secret Service, which was not fun for them. They had to assume that a shot had been fired in the immediate vicinity of the president, and only one shot, which have a very, very bad outcome. And so, that, of course, they came at a dead run. But it was a bad thing.
So, did you guys get tackled and everything else? Or
They didn't say anything at the time. I mean, they just kind of caught their breath, and they were very concerned that the president was down. Everyone was relieved that everyone was okay. And nothing really got said there except that we, President Ford and I, both apologized to them because it was a very, very traumatic experience for those guys. And then later in the day, because I was Jermaine and I were guests of the first family, we didn't get taken aside or anything like that. And everybody understood, you know, that it was just a dumb thing that happened.
Right.
But when I got down to the gate that night, the chief agent of President Ford's detail was there with another one. And when they didn't chew me out or anything like that, but they wanted to see what this thing was, make sure that a bullet couldn't be fired through it. And we had a nice discussion about it, but they said, you know, we see that it's, you know, safe to use around him and all that, but in the future, please let us know when you're going to shoot that thing off, because it just was not a good thing. So that was quite an experience. I mean, it was just kind of unbelievable.
And then in Vail, had another episode with the puppies and in an unexpected act.
The Fords were getting ready to go to Vail for their summer vacation. They generally went to Vail twice a year, summer vacation, winter vacation. And it was in the news. Everybody knew they were going to Vail. So, of course, I knew it because of my job with White House Communications Agency. So I get a call from somebody that says President Ford would like for you to join him in the Oval Office. So I come down from my office and go in the Oval Office, and he's got Liberty in there. And she had already been bred. She was pregnant. And he says, we're going to be going to Vail for 10 days or something. And I said, yes, I knew that. And he said, well, what do you think about Liberty going? And I said, oh, that'd be fine. She can go. She's not that far along. She can definitely go to Vail. And he said, I'd like to take her along, but I'm not going to take her unless you go. And that put me in a difficult position because I was the what was called a trick chief, kind of the shift leader of a three-person team that recorded ABC, NBC, and CBS News every night. And it takes three people to do it. Two people just can't do it. So I said, gosh, my job here just precludes me from doing that. I can't. And they were leaving that, you know, within the hour. And I said, I don't think I can go. But I said, she's fine to go. Just go ahead and take her. And he said, I'm not going to take her unless you go. And I really would like to take her. And I said, Mr. President, I'm sorry, but I just can't go. It's not fair to the people that I work with. And so this conversation went on. He advocated for his position and I advocated for mine. And on the Ford Presidential Library and Museum website are daily diaries of President Ford. And this particular, these entries are in his daily diary for that day, that Mr. Brockett met with the president in the Oval Office, that Mr. Brockett and the president walked together to the residence. And then there's about a 30-minute span of time where we're in the residence together, and then the president departs from the South Lawn for Andrews Air Force Base. And that entire time, he was trying to talk me into, and I even said, I don't even have any clothes up there with me. He said, that's okay. There'll be planes coming out every day. Jermaine can send clothes out to you. And I said, I just can't go. Well, I won. I won that one. And except I wound up with the dog for those 10 days because he would not take her out to Vail without me. So So I had to take Liberty home and take care of her at home.
Listening to you, you get a real feel for Gerald Ford, the man. And, you know, it's so unfortunate that some people remember him, you know, and we talked about this before the interview, you know, back to the Saturday Night Live days and Chevy Chase falling all over and kind of as a bumbling mm-hmm. boob. And he was anything but. He was a really decent guy and a great athlete. I mean, did that bother him? It seemed like he had a pretty good sense of humor, though, that he knew was part of the job. How did he feel about that?
Think it bothered him at all. I mean, he was very comfortable in his own skin. And when I knew him, quite athletic. David Kennerly, the White House photographer, did a book a couple of years ago called Extraordinary Circumstances. It's a photographic history of the Ford presidency. Primarily, it's photographs and thoughts of people that were in the administration. Lots of quotes in there, family members. It's a great book. Coffee table book. In the middle of that book, there's a picture of President Ford and Terry O'Donnell, who I mentioned before, who was the President Ford's appointment secretary. And the two of them are walking along the portico right by what would be the cabinet room. And it's a photograph that David took. And Terry is looking out across the Rose Garden, and he's got just a kind of a little smile on his face. But President Ford, he looks literally in this picture, he looks like he's 10 feet tall and made of steel. He's walking very erect, trim, in a suit, but just, for his age, which he probably would have been about 64 then, maybe outstanding shape. And the look on his face is like he has absolutely the weight of the world on his shoulders. And it's an interesting contrast because you don't pick that up from Terry O'Donnell. So my take from that photo is that something was weighing on Gerald Ford that Terry O'Donnell had no idea about. And if you flip the page to the next page in the book, there's a picture, one of my favorites, in the first photo that I was given of a signed photo by President Ford and Liberty. Her paw print is on it. It's a picture of him in his chair in the Oval Office, and Liberty has got her front seat up in his lap, if I remember right, and she's got her head leaned back over backwards, and she's looking at David Kennerly, who took the picture. It's just an awesome picture of the two of them. And it has a lot of meaning to me because I look at this one picture and I say, here's this guy with the weight of the world on his shoulders, which how often did he feel that way? And I flip the page, and here's this guy having a great time with this dog that I trained for him, you know, just on two consecutive pages of that book. It's really amazing.
Well, you say something. I was reading some of what you'd written about him, and you said, you know, he's one of those rare people in life who you'd never heard an unkind word spoken. And I think of myself as kind of a person who's followed politics close all my life. You hear a lot of people that may not like his politics, but I had never heard anybody say they didn't like the man, you know, the way they did about Nixon or Clinton, you mm-hmm. know, or basically everybody else. Was he really that kind of guy that just everybody liked? You never heard anybody say anything bad about him?
Well, yeah, I've never read or heard anything bad about him. The first that I ever heard was that quote that I gave you from Carl Bernstein, you know, the son of a bitch, pardon the son of a bitch. And that had no, that wasn't directed at Gerald Ford as being that. It was just the frustration that Carl Bernstein was feeling at the moment that, you know, they had done all this work to uncover all this information on Nixon, and now he was going to get off scot-free. And it was just more than Carl Bernstein could take at the moment, I think. But, no, I mean, there's so many terms that people use that knew him to describe, genuine, kind, all of those. And when Germaine, my first wife, when we moved in the White House, that month that we stayed when the puppies were born, September of 1975, we talked earlier about the two assassination attempts, and it was an unbelievable month. In the middle of that month, Germaine began not to feel too well, and Mrs. Ford learned about it probably from Susan, and she came up and said, I want Germaine to go down and see Dr. Lukacs, who was President Ford's personal physician, an admiral in the Navy, whose office was on the ground floor of the residence. That's another interesting thing that I didn't talk about, is a little bit about the difference between the Nixons and the Fords. And you may have to help me get back here in a second to Dr. Lukacs' office on the ground floor. But I referred to it, you heard me refer to it as the residence. When Nixon was president, it was referred to as the mansion. And the Nixon presidency was much more an imperial presidency, and the Ford presidency was much more of just a normal guy. So, you know, the Nixon girls, Julie Nixon, Eisenhower, I met her a couple times after her parents left when they were moving things out of the White House and all. Just a genuinely nice person. David Eisenhower, really nice person. Her sister, I don't know at all. But they always wore dresses. When Susan became, you know, when Susan's dad became president, part of the stuff that appeared in the paper was, you know, can you believe that the president's daughter wears blue jeans? I mean, she took a lot of grief over wearing blue jeans. It was just a big transition. But
seems
anyway,
stupid in this day and age, but people don't realize back then, watch carefully. I mean, it's amazing. And she got a lot of grief from things that Betty Ford had said about her, too, which really wasn't about her, just thinking what might have been. They just were really honest, decent people, and some people couldn't handle
it. Yeah. Just, they just said what they thought. You're talking about the 60-minute interview. And another thing, you know, that the Nixon girls were always referred to as Miss Julie and Miss Tricia by the White House staff. And when I say the White House staff, I mean the resident staff, or in that case, it was the mansion staff, which is the permanent White House staff, the butlers, the maids, the people that take care of the first family in their residence. They were referred to as Miss Julie and Miss Tricia. And when the Fords came in, they wanted to refer to them as, you know, Miss Susan, and she hated that. And I tease her sometimes. She'll call me Mr. Brockett sometimes we're talking, and then I'll call her Miss Susan. She hates that. And I do it just to tease her and get her to quit calling me Mr. Brockett. So anyway, which she's doing just to harass me, I think. And then, but the funny thing that happened was when Jack Ford first came there, they referred to him as Master Jack. And so I used to sing to him, "It's a strange, strange world we live in, Master Jack." Do you remember that song?
I do. It's an old rock band. Oh, yeah.
And I still do that to him to this day. When I see him, I refer to him as Master Jack and sing that song to him. I saw him in November back at the christening of the Gerald R. Ford. I refer to him as Master Jack. And he hates that, too. So anyway, I really digress there, but back to the story of Mrs. Ford sending my first wife down to Dr. Lukacs' office.
Yeah.
So we go down there, and Dr. Lukacs says, I'll take care of her. You can just go do your thing or whatever. So I went off and probably to work or something. So what happened was that he sent off, I guess, a urine sample or something to Bethesda, and it came back that she was pregnant, and that was our first child. So Dr. Lukacs broke that to us later that evening, I think. So when we left his office, we decided to keep it quiet for a while and just not tell anybody.
Wow.
So we went upstairs, and we were living in the residence at that time. We went upstairs, and as the evening progressed and we had dinner and all that, afterwards, Susan and Germaine, my first wife, and I were all up in the solarium. And Susan said, how about some ice cream? And we said, oh, yeah, that'd be great. So it wound up that Susan and I went down to the second floor to the kitchen that the president and Mrs. Ford used, their own personal kitchen, and we were getting ice cream out of the refrigerator, out of the freezer, and three dishes out, and we were dishing them all up. And Mrs. Ford came in, and she was in her robe, and it was probably around 9:30, 10 o'clock at night, and she said, ice cream for the three of you. And we said, yep. And she said, which one is Germaine's? And we said, well, I don't know. And she said, well, you'll know in a minute. And she went in the refrigerator and got out a jar of pickles, and she sliced pickles and put all around the outside of one of the ice cream bowls. And that was her way of telling us that she knew. She knew that.
Isn't that incredible? What a fun group. You know, I got a question for you. As I listen to these great stories and the type of people they were, do you think that they would have liked or disliked today's environment, which involves a lot more, you know, there's this social media, there's a lot more press. I mean, you've got, you know, as you mentioned at the time, there was only, a handful of networks. Now there are countless numbers of networks. There's talk radio. There's all this stuff. Do you think they would have been more comfortable in that, or do you think he would have really, you know, because they did value their privacy. Do you think it would have bothered him more to be, you know, this exposed?
Yeah, I think it would have been more difficult now. I think, you know, they were a product of their time, you know, and they were comfortable with the way it was then, I think. Yeah, I do. After the puppies were born, we typically keep puppies indoors for about 3.5 weeks, and then it's time for them to go outside. So the puppies had transitioned to outdoors, and they were in an outdoor kennel that was over just off the West Wing. But I would, you know, bring them in pretty often and run them a lot on the lawn and that sort of thing. Well, right toward the end of when the puppies were about to go to their homes, my mom and my grandmother flew out from San Diego. And back in those days, it was tours of the White House were handled completely different than they are now post-September 11th. If you wanted to tour the White House, you just got in line over on the East Wing side. And you might have gone through metal detector. You probably did. I never did that tour, so I'm not sure. But, you know, you just got in line, and you went on the tour. And one of the things that I used to do was, as often as I possibly could, I'd take Liberty down to the tours. And I'd walk along the tours and let people pet her, and especially kids. And they'd take pictures with her and all that kind of thing. I did that as often as I possibly could.
Did Liberty like that? I mean,
yeah, she loved it. Yeah, yeah. So golden retrievers are really social dogs. So it was, and it's just, I knew that was probably the closest that they were going to get, you know, to any member of the first family. It was just kind of a cool thing to do. And so, so my mom and grandmother came out. One of the things that we used to be able to get were called personal tours or VIP tours. And so if you worked at the White House and your family members came in, you could request a personal or VIP tour. And what they would try to do was assign one of their tour guides to take your family members through at a different time than the regular tour, and you'd have a personal tour. And those tours might even go to the West Wing, and possibly even into the Oval Office if the president was out of the office. Not always, but sometimes they would. So I made a request for a VIP tour for my mom and grandmother, and the tour office said, "Gosh, you're living in the residence. You know your way around. You know the history of the place pretty well. Unless you really want us to assign somebody to that, why don't you just let us know when you want to do it? We'll let you know where you can go, and you guys take them on a tour." And so we did that. And one of the things that we did arrange was to take them to the third floor of the residence and show them where the puppies had been born and where we stayed when we were actually living there. And I think this was in November of 75. And so when we were up on the third floor, Susan was up there, and she came out of her room, and she met my mom and grandmother, and they had this great talk. And that was just a huge thrill for especially my mom. My grandmother, a little harder to impress, but my mom was really thought that was amazing. And toward the end of that conversation, Susan said, "Have you taken," it was a Sunday, I'm pretty sure. Susan said, "Have you taken them down to meet my mom and dad yet?" And I'm going to back up. It was a Saturday because it was college football day. And I said, no. I said, believe it or not, you don't just do that. You know, you don't just take somebody down. She said, she rolls her eyes, you know, like, because they were just a normal family. It was just a normal family living in a big house that happened to be painted white. And incredible. So she walked over to a phone, and she picked up the phone, and she asked for the usher. And she got the usher's office, and she said, "I'm sending Bill and Jermaine Brockett down with Bill's mom and grandmother. Would you please let my parents know and meet them at the elevator?" And so we get on the elevator, go down one floor, and the usher, who was a lady on call right then, she met us, and she had already let the Fords know. And so she walked us into their living room, and Mrs. Ford was there, and she met my mom and grandmother, and they probably talked for 10 minutes. And then she said, "Jerry's watching the University of Michigan play somebody. Let me go get him." So she goes and gets him out of his study, and he comes out, and he talks to my mom and grandmother for 5 minutes or so. And then he says, hey, you know, I really got to get back to my game. And then Mrs. Ford said, have you taken them on the tour of this floor yet? And I said, no. And that's the floor that we talked about a little earlier about when Nixon would spend time in the Lincoln sitting room. It has, at that time, it had the treaty room, which was my favorite room in the entire White House. Used to be years ago, you know, a couple hundred years ago or whatever, the cabinet room. It's now called the treaty room, the oval living room. It's and then some other rooms, and then the queen's bedroom, the queen's sitting room, the Lincoln bedroom, the Lincoln sitting room. So she took about an hour, Mrs. Ford did, and walked us through their personal, you know, their bedroom, their where she gets her hair done, their kitchen, their private dining room, all of that end, his study where he was watching TV and all that, and then all those other rooms. And then we all said goodbye. And by the time my mom made it home to San Diego, nobody asked for an address. They just, you know, called and said, we need the address of where Bill Brockett's mom lives. By the time my mom and grandmother made it home, there was a note in the mail from Mrs. Ford thanking my mom and grandmother for taking the time out of their busy schedule to come by and see her.
Wow! If nothing tells the story of the Fords, that certainly does. But what a fun group! You know, I'm wondering. I know you're still friends with Susan and Jack and so forth. Yeah, without any specifics, I'm just trying to get an idea. But when they see everything that goes on in Washington, does it just kind of shock them of what's going on there, or do they kind of think like, "Thank God we're not there anymore"? Or, you know, what's kind of their feeling?
Yeah, the one I talk to the most or communicate with the most is Susan, and. Specific to that, when Ronald Reagan died, and I watched a lot of the coverage that went on, you know, day after day.
Right.
And I realizing that her dad, Susan's dad at that time, was in his upper 80s, I thought, gosh, one of the disadvantages, there are definite disadvantages to being a member of the first family.
Oh, yeah.
Let me tell you. And it's not all peaches and cream. One of the disadvantages, I think, is that when one of your parents passes away, you mourn in public for days. And it's very difficult. And I watched it with the Reagans. I actually called Susan and we talked for quite a while. It was like an hour-long conversation. And a lot of it had to do with that very thing. I said, one of these days, and not too distant future, you're going to have to mourn in public. And we talked about it. And I said, it just seems so difficult to me. And we talked about, you know, how to keep the private part private and the public part public. And I was fortunate to have taken part in the what's called the private family memorial service for both President Ford and Mrs. Ford. And those were services that took place at their home church in Palm Desert, and before the more public services, like at the National Cathedral or you know even the church in Grand Rapids. So these were and President Ford's memorial service was a very private affair and not a typical church service. It was more people wandering around, reconnecting with each other. There was a receiving line to talk to Mrs. Ford. All the kids were available, all the Ford kids, and it was a really interesting, a different kind of an experience.
Well, what I read, which I thought was interesting, was it wasn't just diplomats and big famous people. You know, it wasn't what you see sometimes in New York City where they almost look like a celebrity funeral. It's exactly the opposite. You had some of those type, but you also had people, they said there were staff people from the White House, people that you would never expect. And that, again, speaks to the type of people they were.
Exactly. I mean, these were friends and people that they felt like had, you know, been kind to them back then. One of them that I was standing in line with, just a little short Filipino guy, and I said, gosh, you look familiar. And he said, I should look familiar. I used to bring you coffee when you had meetings with President Ford in the Oval Office. And then immediately I knew who he was, not by name necessarily, but I said, right. You were a Navy steward. And he said, yeah. And all the Navy stewards in the White House at that time, they were all Filipinos. And so, you know, I mean, they invited the Navy steward who brought President Ford his coffee every day to his memorial service. And one of the, there was a golf pro there, and I can't think of his name right now, but I had a long talk with him. And he, you know, he struggled through the years to try to teach President Ford to play golf better. And it wasn't, you know, it's like, it was kind of a comedy of errors sometimes when President Ford would play golf, people would, you know, want to wear helmets or something, you know, because there's no telling where the ball was going to go. But he absolutely loved to play golf. And, so that was an amazing experience. Mrs. Ford's memorial service was much more traditional, and that was an interesting service because when I got seated, and then they began to have the more dignitaries come down. The people who came in, Michelle Obama was there, Rosalind Carter was there and spoke, Hillary Clinton was there. So there's three first ladies, you know, it was kind of first ladies honoring first ladies.
Wow, yeah.
And then there kind of fell a hush on the place, and I was just looking up toward the front where these ladies were being seated. And there was kind of a hush that fell on the place, and I turned around, and here, arm in arm, come down the aisle, George W. Bush and Nancy Reagan. And the other person who was at Mrs. Ford's service was Maria Shriver, and it was her first public, it wasn't public, but
right,
her first event that she had attended since the situation, you know, with her and Arnold Schwarzenegger. So, and those type, you know, those types of people, especially if they're going through a trauma in their own life, those services are set up specifically so that the public is not there. The press is not there. It's very private. And those were amazing things to go to. And then I also got to go to the first day of issue ceremony for the Gerald Ford stamp, which took place in Palm Springs.
Hmm.
So those were three. Well, and then the christening of the USS Gerald R. Ford, which is actually referred to right now as CVN-78. But when it's commissioned into the United States Navy, it will be the USS Gerald R. Ford. And that was an amazing experience. So it's been an honor, you know, over the years. It's a low maintenance friendship with the Ford family. I definitely am not a groupie or anything like that. I maintain a friendship with them. Susan and I communicate. We're Facebook friends. Jack, Mike, and Steve, I more see it, functions that I'm invited to. They're all great kids, and you know, have been successful in their own right. And Susan kind of carries the mantle for the family. She's really represents her parents and does an amazing job. I just think she's an awesome person, and she's done a great job of carrying on, you know, with her parents and then for her parents since they both died.
Well, it's just an incredible story. You've lived an incredible life, Bill, I got to say. And the story of Gerald R. Ford and the family is incredible. So let's tell people a couple things. First of all, where's the best place? And I know you know the answer to this. But where is the best place to find out more about President Ford if you happen to be around Michigan and such?
Oh, well, yeah. The interesting thing is that Gerald Ford Library and Museum are the only presidential library and museum that are not co-located. So if you're in the Michigan area, if you're a researcher,
yes,
you want to go to Ann Arbor. And on the University of Michigan campus, 100 Beale Street, been there a couple times, is the Gerald R. Ford Presidential Library, which is that's where the documents are maintained from the Ford presidency, some of which are still classified. Every year they people come from CIA, FBI, NSA, and so forth, and go through documents that are scheduled for declassification and determine which ones will and which ones won't be declassified. But that's the library is strictly for research. The museum, on the other hand, is in Grand Rapids, Michigan. It's an amazing place. I've been there a number of times. I usually try to spend a couple of days, and I take one day and unofficially volunteer as a guide. And I just try to find maybe families with kids. Or one time I found a couple that I felt like were really interested in what was going on. I went up, introduced myself, told them what my background was, and I said, you know, if you have any questions, they said, just walk with us, you know. and I have a great time doing that. But the Ford Museum in Grand Rapids is an amazing experience. Ever changing, you know, there's parts of it that don't change, but lots of.
I love presidential libraries and museums. I think they're incredible. I would love to come back to Michigan, particularly when you're there, Bill. I would love to see it. But for those of us that aren't in Michigan and can't get out there right away, obviously your company is the one that did it. Tell them where they can go on the web to see it.
Well, the conversation I was just talking about a few minutes ago between Susan and I when after Ronald Reagan died, toward the end of that conversation, I said to her, you know, your parents were so kind to me and my family beyond belief. And I've always wanted to do something special for them. But I said, honestly, what do you do special for, you know, former president and first lady? That's just but in the conversation, I said, have you seen the website for the Gerald Ford Presidential Library and Museum? And she said, I have. And I said, what do you think of it? I'm not going to quote exactly what she said, but she said, it stinks. She is a slightly different word. But I said, I'm so glad to hear you say that, because I totally agree. I think it's horrible. And so in that phone conversation, I volunteered to her to redesign the Gerald Ford Presidential Library and Museum website, which is the URL is FordLibraryMuseum.com or .gov, I believe. FordLibraryMuseum.gov. It was a very interesting offer that I made, because a couple things happened. One is she agreed to it right away, and I said, it's just something that I'd like to do for your parents, and both of them were still alive at the time. And so we took it on. The first thing that happened was, because it's a .gov site, it's not private. It belongs to the National Archives,
right?
The United States National Archives. So we had to petition the archives, which took 6 or 8 months, for them to agree to let my company develop a new look and feel for the website to present to them as just an offer to redesign the site, because they had never had a private company redesign a government site before, and it was what I was told. So 6 or 8 months before they would even give us the go-ahead to just work on a design. And then we did the design. It was accepted. And then I said, well, what we'll do, I had one friend who owned his own company, and he had offered to help me. And we said, we'll just redo all the pages. And we were figuring that there were going to be about 200 pages. Well, it turned out there was about 5,000.
Oh, wow.
So that overwhelmed us, of course, right away. And so I said, okay, well, we can't do 5,000 pages. So what we will do is we'll redesign the major pages, the header and all of that, and then I'll fly back to Michigan and transition the redesign over to the library, and we'll bring over students from the university to do it, which is exactly what we did. We did submit it to the two most prestigious web design awards in the world, the Webbies and W3, like www, in 2006, and it won honorary mention in the Webby Awards for the government category, and second place in the www
outstanding
awards. Yeah, it was really really nice. So the website you see today is not the website we designed. It's been transitioned one more time, but it was a great project to do, and it was really an honor to win those two awards. But and the award for the Webbies specifically says that the website was a gift to the Ford family by websitesforless.com, which is my company. So, and that's what it was. If you go to, I think I sent you a link to the About This site page. Mm-hmm. If you go to the Ford Library Museum.gov/ about this site, hyphenated, three words with two hyphens, .asp. It's not, the link is not on the site anymore, but if you go to that about this site, .asp, then you actually see the page that talks describes the project and Susan's in my conversation and the people who helped and all of that. So it was a great project. It was a lot of fun, but it was big.
Well, and for folks that want their website to be at the presidential level, as we're talking there, a great place to go is Websites for Less. Spell it out for people so they can go and check exactly. It's not just that.
Back in the days when I did the Ford site, it was actually called photographics.com, but after the 2008, financial crash, basically, we completely redeveloped the business. We wrote a new business plan. We lowered costs, increased the number of sites we do, and we came up with this name, websitesforless.com, which is four words and three hyphens or dashes. So it's web hyphen sites, plural, hyphen four, F-O-R. Less.com. So we build now beautiful, functional, search engine optimized websites for less than we used to be able to do. And I can explain to people, why.
Anyway, Bill, thank you so much for being with us. We really enjoyed it. And we look forward to talking with you again on some other topics. So thank you so much, Bill.
Okay, Stephen, you have a great day.